Welcome to Canary in a Cornfield, a podcast from the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, where we explore how the policies that shape our food and farming systems impact our health, our communities, and our future. As most of our listeners probably know, the Harkin Institute was founded upon the retirement of longtime public servant and Iowa legend Tom Harkin, in order to continue doing high-quality work on the policy issues that were important to him. All right. Welcome, everyone. I am really excited for our guest, Matthew Dominguez of Compassion and World Farming, which does a lot of great work in the U.S. and around the world, and also came out with a report about food waste that I think is really important and touches on a lot of the issues that we've been talking about here in terms of industrial farming. So, Matthew, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Adam, thank you so much for having me on. And always excited to talk about farm animal issues and how to save the world.
Small topics like that, yes. But First of all, I was hoping you could say a little bit about Compassion and World Farming for people who are not familiar with the group. I know about your work from when I lived over in the UK and also in the US. I know you do incredible things, but why don't you tell me a little bit about the organization?
Yeah, happy to. So Compassion and World Farming is the largest and oldest farm animal organization on the planet. Founded in 1967 by a farmer who had a choice either to go down a path and become a factory farmer himself or to do the right thing and stay true to his morals and his ethics. And him and his wife decided to start a farm animal organization almost 60 years ago, an incredibly impressive origin story and really aligns with who we are as an organization today. I am very privileged to sit in the seat of the U.S. Executive Director, so I run the U.S. office. We have teams all over the globe. I think we're in nearly a dozen countries where our work is one of being pragmatic and being positive. It's one of working with people, whether that be lawmakers or companies or producers or farmers or even consumers, meeting them where they're at and finding the ability to have a path forward to make a better future for farm animals. And our mission goes well beyond just the farm animal aspect, where it is working to create a food system that respects not only the animals, but respects human health and respects the planet itself. So we are a behemoth in this space, but one that in the U.S. is relatively unknown. And the reason for that is we're often working behind the scenes very positively with corporations, with lawmakers to make the world better for animals.
I think one of the things that's really unique about Compassion and World Farming is this global reach. And so could you say a little bit more about how that affects the work that you do?
I think it's one of our strengths as an organization is that we have a global footprint. Of course, many of the organizations that I work with in the U.S. that are primarily focused, whether it's or a state or a region or the country itself, they're doing phenomenal work. And I actually believe deeply that having a very narrow focus in a location or geographic location is very impactful. But it's also important that organizations are out there that have a global reach, because we can learn so much from our neighbors, from other countries, different cultures. I can't tell you the number of times that I've been on calls with my colleagues in the UK or in the Czech Republic or even South America, where tactics or things that they did to be successful have helped migrate over to the US and influence the work we're doing and vice versa. And I think it is a key example of our global CEO, Philip Limbrey, who is just a brilliant mastermind in strategy, and that he realized long ago that a global footprint is in fact a huge bonus to the organization and our superpower. But it's also one that we have to realize that the issue of factory farming, ending factory farming, which is the largest contributor of suffering, one of the largest polluters, one of the largest changers of our climate, this is not a US issue. This is a global issue that we must attack. And that is why we have the footprint that we do. And so very proud to work for a global organization. And like I said, I actually think it's one of our strengths as the report that we're going to talk about highlights.
I lived in the UK for 2 years and was a little bit in the ecosphere of visiting more European academic institutions. And
I just learned so much from that experience of just all these things you take for granted of when you're in one country. It doesn't have to be the US, but when you're in one place, there's all these things that you assume, oh, that's the way it has to be done. And then your eyes are opened when you see how differently it's done in other places around the world. And I'm sure that's just amplified even more dramatically when you're an organization that's strategically working across all these environments.
Yeah, and it's a good reminder, I think, sometimes with the ebbs and flows that we have, and I think most people, no matter where you sit on the political aisle, can agree that the United States is not really in its healthiest place that we've been in a very long time. We are in a climate that's difficult and quite negative. And it's great also to be reminded that progress is being made across the globe. You look at what's happening in the UK and that they're signaling to get rid of cages and crates, period, in the UK. The EU is working really hard to hopefully put a moratorium and end the cage age over in the EU. And so it's a good reminder that there are things for us to be hopeful for. And when we're a little bit down, we can pull some hope from them. And maybe when they're down, they can pull some hope from us. So it's, again, that global footprint is really important for the movement.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Please give me good news. I definitely could use some right now. So I appreciate you saying that. Yeah, thank you for that. I'm also curious to hear more about your background. How did you get involved in Compassionate World Farming? And what did you do before this position?
Like I said, it's very humbling and such an honor to, I get paid to help animals. And there are times where I talk to my friends that don't work in the advocacy space or people that I meet out at the bar or dinner. And I'm reminded that I feel very lucky to be in a position where I can make a living and make a difference in the lives of literally billions of animals, or at least that's what I hope that I'm doing. But my origin story, I think everyone has a unique one about where and what brought them into the current place that they sit. And it's interesting to think about, if you would have told me when I was a child that I would be the U.S. executive director for an organization fighting on behalf of chickens and pigs and cows, I would tell you you're absolutely insane, because I was raised on a cattle ranch. My grandmother had a 1,500-acre cattle ranch in California, Northern California. We ran about 150 head of cattle. I had a pony named Albert, and I went on cattle drives. There's photos of me as a little kid being on my pony doing a cattle drive down the middle of a rural highway, taking our cows from one area of the foothills into the mountains so that they have feed over the summer. But what's interesting is I think that time on that farm is what instilled in me the desire and the need to protect these animals, because I got to know them as individuals. I actually think that the first animal advocate that I met, ironically, was my grandma. I still remember where it was, you are not going to eat breakfast or have dinner until the cows are fed. You are not going to mistreat them. You are going to care for them, whether it's because it's their livelihood, but I also fundamentally believe because she thought it was the right thing to do for them. Now, some people may disagree about the end of life and whether or not we should be taking their life for food, but I do think that there is a considerable amount of suffering that happens to farm animals up to that point. And that's where I think the welfare aspect of things for me really solidified. You know, I played baseball in college. I didn't do animal advocacy. I would say that I was your typical, just like, menace as a child and as a barely graduated high school because I didn't care. I was going to be a baseball player. And then when I went to law school, I took some philosophy classes and just started exercising that part of my brain of thinking about the impact that we have in the world, morals and ethics and values of who we are as people. It led me to go to Lewis and Clark Law School, where I went for the environmental law program, but quickly got indoctrinated with the animal law program. And I was the co-director of SALDIP. I was on the law review. I was surrounded by some of the kindest, smartest professors and people that were making an argument over a decade ago that seems almost foolish to think that they were doing, that animals deserve protection in the law, that there was this thing called animal law. Granted, we take it for granted now that nearly every law school has an animal law class, that we're regularly seen in the courts as a legitimate social justice movement and working on legal protections. We're not laughed at in the legislature anymore. 15 years ago, that wasn't the case. And it was really in law school, those 3 years, where when you start to learn about these issues, shark finning, we kill hundreds of millions of sharks every year and we're collapsing the ecosystem, fur farming, factory farming, horse slaughter for human consumption. The list goes on and on about the atrocities that humans inflict on billions of animals. And I felt morally compelled that I need to do something about this. And it was right there in that moment during my first year of law school at this luncheon at the Student Legal Defense Fund where I had this epiphany of I have to do something. It wasn't an aha, yes, I'm excited moment. It was a, oh crap, I need to do something about this moment and felt morally compelled to do this work. Fast forward, worked at the Humane Society of the United States, which is now the Humane World for Animals. I was the director of public policy for farm animal protection. I did a lot of really great work within coalitions to ensure that we could still do undercover investigations and fight what are called ag-gag bills that were laws that seek to criminalize undercover investigations. So I'm very proud of the work that I and many of my colleagues did to keep undercover investigations legal in the United States, pass legislation in states like Massachusetts and California and others to ban the extreme confinement of farm animals, which is the hallmark of factory farming, which is taking a large number of animals and putting them in a barn and treating them like commodities rather than living beings. So worked on legislation to end those and a whole host of other work around plant-based and other things. So it's been a fun career, but about a year ago, the opportunity came up to take over the U.S. Office for Compassion and World Farming. And the reason I decided to do this work is I believe that working with corporations and lawmakers positively, meeting people where they're at is the future. It's how we're going to move forward. I think we have enough negativity in the world as is, and it's really time for charities to step up to just do more of the positive work to move companies along. And very proud to do that work with my colleagues here at Compassion.
I really appreciate that story and the moral base that's driving where you're coming from. A couple of thoughts that came to mind after you were talking. Definitely, we're very familiar with ag gag laws here in Iowa. Yeah. Might be the originator. You're reminding me we should probably do a deep dive on that. And then also, we just recently were talking with Neil Hamilton, and he was talking about agricultural law, and it went through a similar process of initially being dismissed and then slowly becoming more integrated into law schools around the country. And Lewis and Clark, wasn't that one of the first animal law programs in the country?
Yeah, Lewis and Clark was, I think, the first to have an animal law program. It was some really incredibly brilliant people with the forethought to be like, we're going to create this here at this law school. And now it's almost, I think nearly every law school has, or at least most of them have at least an animal law class. It was the first to have the Student Legal Defense Fund's student chapter. They were the first animal law review, really putting it on the map. But now even Harvard has an animal law program. Yale has an incredible program focuses on agriculture, animals, and the environment. So it is here to stay as a discipline in the legal system. And to your point, it reminds me of a story with the first laws that I ever passed were to ban gestation crates, veal crates, and cattle tail docking for dairy cows in the little state of Rhode Island. Our bill sponsor, Representative Pat Sterpa, wonderful retired teacher and incredibly passionate animal protection lawmaker, just had many years working with her. And I remember when she first introduced her bill to ban the extreme confinement of farm animals in Rhode Island. Her Democratic colleagues on the floor of the Rhode Island Senate would oink and moo and cluck at her as a joke of, are you really doing this? This isn't a serious thing to work on. Within 3 years of passing those laws, and when we went to work on banning battery cages for egg-laying hens, which are these tiny little intensive confinement wired barren battery cages where they house multiple egg-laying hens, one of the worst torturous housing systems that humans have ever created. There were lawmakers fumbling over themselves to carry our bill because they knew that not only did the general public care about this, but their constituents and people voted because of that. And so it was really amazing to see over even just a 2 or 3 year period, a lawmaker go from this is a pet project, pun intended, to this is a serious matter to consider. And we're continually reinforced by that, by Prop 12, in California and Question 3 in Massachusetts passing by 60% and 70% respectively when the voters had a chance to vote on those issues. It's really great to see that this is no longer an issue where people are like, should we take you serious? It's a matter of, it is serious. It's just how do we move forward now?
It's great to see that shift when people pay more attention. And I think once the information is in front of them, it makes it more clear why we should be concerned about it. But I wanted to get to the main subject of this interview, which was this really important and impressive report that Compassion and World Farming put out recently. And I saw you in the media talking about this report, and I think it's really relevant to what's happening in Iowa. Iowa has very serious environmental and public health problems because of our agricultural system And of course, our agricultural system is the epitome of being designed to maximize production as much as possible. Just plant every square inch with corn or soybeans and fit as many pigs and chickens as you can into confinement. We're very familiar in Iowa with the fact that all of our food systems have an environmental impact. So given that there's an environmental impact from food systems, it makes sense that if you're wasting food, you are having an environmental impact that's not getting any benefits. And so food waste is a really huge issue that has serious environmental and public health consequences, which I'm sure you can tell me more about. But I thought your report was really important because it's about food waste and a dimension of food waste that I think many people aren't really aware of. So tell me more about the report and what the findings were.
Yeah, it's a very comprehensive report that I'm very proud of my colleagues, primarily over in the UK, that have worked on putting this document together. When most people think about those who oppose factory farming, most people think to their mind that it's animal welfare. And rightfully, again, industrial farming the cause of the most amount of suffering on the planet, with the billions and billions of animals, whether it's from the housing system or routine cutting off of their body parts without any type of painkillers and then the slaughter itself. But there is something that has gone unrecognized when it comes to industrial factory farming. And simply put, it's the world's largest waste of food. And the report emphasizes that case. When most people think about food waste, they think about when they go to a restaurant and only eat 3/4 of their portion, or food that goes bad before they have the time to eat it. And of course, there is a considerable amount of food waste in households and restaurants that happen, but that is dwarfed by the food waste that goes into how we raise animals in the United States and also globally. So put this in simple terms, most people don't consider that a cow doesn't just simply grow, or a pig doesn't simply grow, or a chicken simply doesn't grow on its own. It requires, like us, a lot of food and a lot of water. And as you can imagine, that growing food for the purpose of feeding it to an animal to then raise and then to slaughter, then to have it consumed by animals. Factory farming will tell you that the reason for factory farming is just because it's efficient. They believe that smaller spaces, putting them in cages, this is about efficiency and making more money. But what they don't tell you is this is an incredibly inefficient system when it comes to the protein and caloric intake of what we're growing. So if you have an acre of land and you grow food on that acre of land, if you were to choose to grow X number of calories for human consumption, it would be a direct calorie to calorie transfer. But when you grow, say, 100 calories on a piece of land, you feed it to an animal, and then that animal is then slaughtered and killed in order to make food, you have a decrease of anywhere between 75% to 98% caloric and protein deficiency in that system. So you are wasting anywhere between 75 and 98% of the food that is edible and otherwise could go to humans and that land be used to feed humans. It is one of the most inefficient systems on this planet. And yet factory farmers claim that it's about efficiency and why they move to the type of model of food system. But it is wasting tremendous amount of food in the United States and globally. And there's estimates based in this report that if we were to take all of the grains and cereals and soy and corn that we grow to feed to livestock and animals, and instead use that land to feed humans, we would be able to feed an additional 2 billion people each year. And in a time when we have food insecurity in the United States, we have millions of children going to bed hungry. It is no more important time to raise awareness around the fact that we are literally wasting food in a system that is just incredibly destructive to our health and to the animals and the planet.
That's an amazing number. And of course, if you're growing food more efficiently, that also means that you don't have to use as much land. And I think in Iowa, we're one of the states that has the fewest naturally preserved lands. And so I think there are pretty big implications here if so much of our land wasn't devoted to this corn and soy system that is primarily focused on animal feed and ethanol. That could free up a lot more land here for whether it's natural areas or growing food for humans or diversified crops. But I think it's also extremely important in the global context, too. So could you say a little bit more about just the importance of land use globally in terms of how it's used for animal feed?
Absolutely. This report found that we feed roughly 1,000 million tons of grain, cereal, soy, corn to farm animals each year. Because of that metric that I talked about, the inefficiency, it's roughly about 766 million tons of that grain is essentially wasted. It is never transferred calorically or from a protein standpoint, nutritionally to humans. If we were to switch the system to one where we didn't do that, it would convert roughly 175 million hectare of land to better use. That roughly, that 175 is about twice the size of Texas globally. So imagine Texas is a massive state. It takes nearly 2 to 3 days to drive across. You would save that much land because we wouldn't need to continue growing feed for farm animals. And so we're talking about not only land use, but we also have to think about the resources that go into producing food that is never fed to humans. And so when folks talk about factory farming being one of the biggest contributors to greenhouse gases, what we're talking about is the fuel, the transport, the water, the degradation of our soil, the pollution that goes into producing animals in particular. It's also a huge strain on water resources, on land resources, on soil. It's destroying our oceans, as you can see in Delaware, where you have the runoff from the broiler farms that are going into the Chesapeake Bay and absolutely decimating the water there. You also have the fertilizer. When you monocrop, particularly if you are a farmer and your only goal, which are subsidies in the United States, and this is one of the policy assets to change our subsidy system, is to not push people into doing a monocrop of just corn or soy for feed, you destroy the soil, you over-fertilize, you have to use a whole host of chemicals to keep those crops going because there's no ecosystem balance of rotating crops, having farm animals on the land. And what you end up having is not only are we depleting resources around our soil, our water, our energy use, all of that, but then on top of that, you are destroying the ecosystem by pulling out all the nutrients in the soil that never goes to humans. We are then polluting it with chemicals, which causes whole host issues. And we're having collapses of ecosystems. This report highlights that this is a global issue, particularly that if we take what we're doing in the Northern Hemisphere and we promote and we push factory farming to the global South, we're not talking about issues of raising tides. We're not talking about extreme weather. We're talking truly about extinction level catastrophic impact from this. Either we decide to regenerate, to be a holistic type of food system that we're working on that is climate friendly, that is in balance with nature and balance with animals and human health and plant forward, we are facing extinction. We are surpassing our planetary boundaries when it comes to the ecosystem that allows us to survive on this planet. This is not a small issue. This is one that we and our children are going to be facing in a catastrophic way in the next decade or two.
We had a guest on recently, Walter Willett, who was part of the Eat Lancet report, and he talked about the necessity of changing our diets for the sake of not pushing past planetary boundaries as well. I also wanted to touch on, since you mentioned climate change, an issue that I care quite a lot about is the rainforests and the role of
deforestation.
Yeah, deforestation and the connection there between both raising cattle, but also the soy. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that dimension of things.
When we talk about resource depletion, soil, water, energy, clean air, all of those things, the one thing I didn't mention and should have, and I'm glad you brought this up, is deforestation. I'm sure many people that listen to your podcast know, and people should know, that the forests are a critical component to us having oxygen on this planet. For us to have an habitable Earth, our planet, it requires for us to have living creatures, trees, and others that create oxygen into this world. Our rainforests, particularly when you're talking about Brazil and other parts of South America, we are seeing a historic depletion of that resource when it comes to the destruction of millions of acres of land every year that are being cleared, not only to raise cattle for beef, But ironically, tearing down our ecosystem to raise crops, to then feed to the cattle, to then feed to humans. And when you're talking about that inefficiency again, so if you were to have 100 acres of edible food in the rainforest that you've torn down, not only have you destroyed that ecosystem and that natural resource that we need to survive, only anywhere between 10 to 2 of those acres are then calorically pushed back to us through that animal. It's the definition of inefficient. If I were to hand you a dollar and you gave me 3 cents back, how many times do you think I would do that? And yet that is our agricultural policy here in the United States. And it also doesn't help the fact that our Secretary Kennedy just came out with a dietary pyramid. It's not a pyramid. It's flipped upside down. And in fact, has a rotisserie chicken at the top and whole fat food. We could go into a whole podcast about the health implications of this on humans, but this is going to further push us into a zone of eating more and more animal-based protein, more and more animal-based products, which is going to further deplete resources. And the trajectory that we actually have, if you look at the report and it goes into the projections of where we're headed, it is truly catastrophic. And the one thing we didn't account for here in the United States when we did this report is the fact that Secretary Kennedy would come out with a dietary guideline that is going to accelerate this incredibly inefficient system. So when it comes to the rainforest, when it comes to forests, and we're talking about incredibly important land, it gives us air and oxygen and all of the important things that we need to have a healthy planet. This system, this Food Not Feed campaign, highlights that we are destroying these ecosystems in numbers that we cannot recuperate from. It's no longer stopping it from happening. It's now about mitigating the damages so that we don't push it further.
That's unfortunately where we're at. I also wanted to mention, so the report talks a fair amount about soy. And I think sometimes one of the things you hear people say is, did you know that soy is actually driving deforestation, with the implication that soy-based foods that people eat are harmful? So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about soy in the context of this too.
As someone who is a plant-based eater, my diet has a considerable amount of soy in it. But it's actually quite funny to think about anyone making the argument that the soy that is consumed, whether it's through soy milk or tofu or any numerous other things that soy goes into, if you were to look at a scale or you were to graph like the number of soybeans or acres that go into producing soy for edible crops versus soy that is raised or grown to then be fed to farm animals, it is completely imbalanced. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the vast majority, I wouldn't be surprised if it were 80, 90% of the soy that is grown in the United States is either fed to farm animals in the United States, or it's exported out to be fed to farm animals in other countries, which, again, just think about that. Our United States policy, our agricultural policy with your and my taxpayer dollars is incentivizing growing crops that is destroying our planet for chemical, soil, all the reasons we talked about, is incentivizing farmers to not raise food that's for humans, but rather to grow corn and soy to then be fed to farm animals inefficiently. But then also to take that food that otherwise could go to humans, to put it in trucks, ship it to ports, put it on a ship, and ship it to other countries to then feed to farm animals. It is the definition of inefficiency. I think we should actually change it in Webster's dictionary of just demonstrating the Food Not Feed campaign to being what inefficiency means. It's factory farming. I can't think of a system that's more inefficient when you're talking about the inputs that go in and the outputs that you get.
One thing that I know some of my listeners would wonder about is you're talking about factory farming. Does the report touch on different types of animal agriculture, like grazing on pasture, and how that fits into the overall picture?
When you're talking about the role that farm animals play in our ecosystem, if we choose to continue to consume animal products, which is very likely in the foreseeable future, it's one that we need to move our current industrial system of factory farming to a more holistic, nature-friendly one. And it could be no surprise to anyone that farm animals can play an important role in regenerative farming practices. And so they are animals that are able to help with the soil. They fertilize, and that's why rotating crops and animals through different fields is incredibly important. And I would highly recommend, there's a couple of books that I could recommend for you to come on this to talk specifically about regenerative farming and what that means. We call it nature-friendly farming. The reason why is because at the end of the day, we're very concerned that regenerative farming is going to become a greenwash term that big companies use to say that they care about the environment, but they simply don't. But we know a lot of regenerative farmers that are doing great work. We want to see into the future. And so when we're talking about a future with animals, what we're talking about is that farm animals should be fed with things that otherwise shouldn't be going to, they could be otherwise going to humans to eat. And so you're talking about pasture and other grasslands. So they should be on pasture. They should be eating grass from fields. One, it's more in harmony with the ecosystem itself. It's better for the animals and it's better for the farmers. We're also finding that farm animals that are treated humanely, raised on pasture-based, done in what we can at least agree upon is a better system. They're nutritionally more dense, they're healthier, and the food tastes better. It is a win-win across the board. The byproducts that should be fed to them are things like brewer's grains, citrus pulps, and sunflower meal. So there are byproducts currently in our food system that are simply just now dumped that could otherwise be brought in to be fed to farm animals that otherwise wouldn't be going to humans. There's also unavoidable food waste in our current system. And so again, we talk about in the United States, food waste of nearly 75% or more, or three times more food waste that comes from factory farming with the system that we're talking about, feeding grains to animals versus just feeding directly to humans. There is a substantial amount of waste, roughly 50 to 60 billion tons or million tons of food waste that happens in the United States around restaurants and companies that produce food. That food, like unwanted bakery products and vegetables and fruits, if we had a system that incentivized collecting food that otherwise isn't human grade but can go to farm animals, we would significantly reduce our dependency on growing grain that otherwise could go to humans. So there is a lot of ways that we can feed farm animals that are more in line with a better policy that is not as wasteful, in addition to one that is in more in harmony with the farm animals themselves, like being pasture-based.
That's really good to hear. And you've already transitioned a little bit to talking about different systems or different policies, but I know that a substantial part of the report is focused on solutions and suggestions.
Specifically, there are seven policies that we're proposing globally. In the United States, I would say it's really more focused on subsidies. If you were to look, I wouldn't necessarily say the current dietary guidelines, but let's go back to the dietary guidelines that we can at least agree, just the last dietary guidelines that were a little bit more based on science and actual research. If you were to look at the meal plan of that dietary guideline and see how that it's carved up when it's talking about proteins and milk and eggs and fruits and vegetables and grains, a balanced diet that is recommended for Americans. If you were to look at that as a plate or a pie chart, and then you compared that to the subsidies the government hands out to grain farmers and to industrial factory farmers, such as the NPPC and those that are alike, it is incredibly unbalanced. There is no taxpayer dollars going to subsidize fruits and vegetables compared to that of grains and raising livestock. And frankly, there's no money going into the farming that I think if you ask most people where they think their food is coming from or where their food should come from, it doesn't go to those types of farms. It goes to the metal sheds where animals are confined in spaces where they can't even stand up and even turn around and extend their limbs. For us in the US, we're focusing on talking about this wasteful system, raising awareness around it, but then also arguing strongly that our taxpayer dollars should be better aligned with what we know our food policy to be, which should be much more heavily on fruits and vegetables and grains. With, if you're going to have animal products that are becoming from regenerative farming, they should be higher welfare, and it shouldn't be one where we're feeding this inefficient system that's destroying our planet. But more specifically in the report, we talk about, of course, first and foremost, we just simply need to reduce the number of grains and soy that we feed to farm animals. There are other wastes that we can feed to them, in addition to, again, being on grasslands, being on pasture, and feeding non edible food to, from human waste to the farming industry. We really need to start adopting a food first land policy. This would be policies both on the state, local, and federal level that incentivize, whether it's through taxes or subsidies, to incentivize farmers to grow food for humans. It sounds silly, but it should be a policy in the United States that our land is primarily used when used for farming to feed humans, not to feed farm animals. We, of course, want to end the subsidy support that you have in grain, because if you reduce the subsidies, so let's say we take all the subsidies that we put into grain and soy, and we stop manufacturing this cheap meat. Why is it that you can walk into McDonald's and buy a hamburger and it's far less than going and getting a salad somewhere? That's not the way it should be. So what we could do is remove subsidies from soy and grain. We level the playing field where farmers that grow human edible crops have a leg up where they can actually compete with having their apples and fruits and oranges and kale and lettuce actually be priced lower than animal products, which it should. When you think about the resources that go into 1 pound of chicken, it should not be cheaper than 1 pound of salad. That is not a true reflection of the cost. We, of course, need to raise public awareness around this in the resource inefficiencies, but then also the pollution that goes into this. We want and ask for the public to really take a lead where we're working with companies to work with the procurement teams that they have to make this a priority, whether it's at schools or hospitals or whatnot. We, of course, need to have an honest conversation about the fact that we can't move away from this inefficient system and have people continue eating the amount of meat that we currently eat in this country. We need to start having an honest conversation about we need a much more plant-forward diet. That doesn't mean you have to go vegan. It doesn't mean stop eating animal products. It means consuming less. And then, of course, the last step is working with the financial institutions, the banks, and others that prop up industrial animal agriculture to have them assume the risk and the detrimental impacts that these practices have, so that there is, again, a balanced playing field for regenerative family farmers that are doing the right thing. So those are the 7 things that we're primarily working on. But here in the U.S., we're having conversations in Congress and with thought leaders across the country in food policy about we simply need to change our subsidies so that we are putting money in the pockets of family farmers that are growing food for humans. We need a food first land policy here in the United States.
Sounds like a really great set of recommendations, and it reinforces that people just are not aware of how much we are already subsidizing the current system. If you talk about we should put more money into food grown for humans, someone might say, oh, keep government out of it. But the reality is government is
already involved.
Our food system is a result of the policies that were designed to protect the companies that are currently on top. One thing I wanted to ask you a little bit more about was you brought up a really interesting point about having the companies assume the appropriate level of risk. So I was wondering if you could expand on that idea just a little bit, because that's a really interesting thought.
It's not just the risk, but it's also the impact. We have created financial institutions that are making a tremendous amount of money from animal agriculture without assuming any of the risk and the impact that it's currently having. So if you were to look at the strain on the healthcare system here in the United States, a vast majority of the strain that is happening, the sickness that we are having, diseases, cancer, all of those things, the top 10 killers of humans and the top 10 things impacting human health, the vast majority of them are food-based. It is what we are putting in our body. It's what we're consuming. We are an unhealthy country, and the dietary guidelines that just came out, that food pyramid that's flipped upside down, is certainly not going to help. We're talking about billions and billions of dollars that are being spent in the healthcare systems, the premiums that we're paying for healthcare, the money that we are then giving to the healthcare system is covering and expending a tremendous amount of money on fixing health problems that come from a poor food system because we've incentivized people to grow grains, feed farm animals, and eat crappy food. That is the food system that we have in the United States. And so if you were to take the impact that our food system has, and you were to take all of the negative impact, whether it's the pollution in our ocean, in our river, the clean water we can't breathe, You talk about factory farms are a huge leader in asthma in communities where these factory farms are. You look at all of the issues that factory farming plagues our society with, those externalities, and you were to monetize them, and you were to require the financial institutions that are backing factory farming to assume that risk and assume that cost, it would cost you $20, $25 to buy a hamburger at McDonald's. Because that is the true cost of a piece of meat. The numbers are staggering. So one statistic that always just blows my mind, not only just the fact that if you feed 100 calories of food to a chicken, you're probably going to get anywhere between 15 and 20% out of it. That alone is insignificant. The numbers are something like 1 pound of chicken, 1 pound of chicken, it's something like 200 or 300 gallons of water to produce that. Not only for the crops that they have to eat, but then for the animal itself and transportation and all of that. But just think about that. Like people say, oh, I'm going to shower less, or I'm not going to water my lawn, or I'm going to do this or do that. If you just eat 1 less pound of chicken, you will save more water than any of those other things that you're planning on doing. And so at the end of the day, this system, not only the feed portion of this, but in every context, this is an inefficient system that doesn't take on the actual responsibility of what it's doing to our planet. Again, we need the financial institutions, the insurance companies, and the folks that prop up factory farming to actually take on the responsibility, the debt, the harm that they have caused, because that is when we're actually going to get a true capitalist system that allows for free market. People talk about the free market and we don't want government to get involved. The government's involved propping up this very bad thing. And if you actually took away all of the support that factory farming would have, I guarantee you most people switch to a plant-based diet, not only because it's cheaper, but it's just better for them. But we don't have a level playing field. And that's really what we need to focus on, amongst many other things.
I think you've done an amazing job showing how important this report is. I really appreciate it. I'll include a link to the report, which is 70-ish pages, but there's also an executive summary at the beginning, so people can read however much in depth that they want, but it's a really impressive report. And could you tell me, Matthew, for folks who want to get more involved and support Compassionate World Farming's work, what would you recommend?
Yeah. So, of course, follow us on our social media. If you have the ability to donate to the organization, we are a 501c3. You can go to ciwf.org to learn about the work that we're doing. But also, not only just supporting our organization, but I would strongly recommend people start to think about, there are two areas of our life where we have the opportunity to voice our true values. Every time you sit down to eat, every time you go to the grocery store, you are physically taking money and voting with your dollars on what you want this world to look like. And if you are someone who does not want to see animals caged in crates and cages their entire life where they can't stand up, turn around, extend their limb, or you agree with us that we should not be growing crops inefficiently to feed to farm animals and then feed to humans, that if you believe we should have a better food system that is better for farmers, for workers, for animals, for the environment, you have that opportunity. Every time you sit down to eat, every time you go to the grocery store, you can vote with those dollars. And then, of course, more importantly, getting involved in what your elected officials, the people that represent you on the state level, on the local level, and in Congress, reach out to them. Let them know food policy matters to you, that you want one that's more humane, that you want one that's better for the public health, that's better for your health, yours and your family, but then also better for the planet. And so at the end of the day, I would actually say, I would love your support for the organization, but more importantly, vote with your dollars. Let your values shine through what you choose to spend money on, because you're either backing the bad guys or you're backing the good guys. And I really hope that this report will open up people's eyes to realize that, wow, a lot of money that I spend every single day or every single year is going to some really inefficient and really bad systems.
Well said. And I know you mentioned earlier that you'd like to work with hospitals and institutions that are providing food. Are there any particular types of groups or organizations that Compassionate World Farming would especially be interested in working with?
Yeah. So there are a couple really phenomenal groups, but one in particular that I just absolutely adore is an organization called Greener by Default. Greener by Default is this really phenomenal group that works with hospitals and schools and other institutional buyers. So as you can imagine, you changing your diet does have an impact and it's worth doing. But if you can get the New York school system to change the diets and feed better food to students, you have an impact that's of the magnitude of millions and millions. Hospitals as well. Very ironic, right? When you go into a hospital and you're fed food that is the very thing that probably puts you in the hospital. We need better food policy when it comes to our institutions. But Greener by Default is an organization that goes in and works with these facilities and these institutions to put more plant-based food on the menus. And really strongly support that because not only does it lower their costs, it's better for the students, it's better for the patients, it's better for everyone involved. And also it's better for the environment. If you're looking to get involved with anything like that, I highly recommend you check out Greener by Default, one of my favorite groups that just popped up in the last couple of years.
They actually won a Harkin on Wellness Award a couple of years ago. So I'm
phenomenal.
A fan as well. Thank you so much, Matthew. Really appreciate the excellent work that you guys do. And thank you for joining me on the podcast. It was great information.
Thanks for having me on, Adam. Look forward to returning and thank you for all the work that you do.
That's it for this week's episode of Canary in a Cornfield. Just a reminder, you can find the Harkin Institute on social media, which includes X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and find our webpage at harkininstitute@drake.edu. And this podcast is also hosted by Substack Canary in a Cornfield, which will include some additional links and resources that go beyond just what's in the episode. So thank you all for tuning in, and I will be talking with you soon.